Welcome to The Road Untraveled. I'm your host, Brian Hollins, and today I'm so excited to share my episode with David Tisch, founder of Box Group. I can't read a VC or tech newsletter these days without seeing Box Group get into another incredible company. And their portfolio includes names like ClassPass, Glossier, Flatiron Health, Harry's, PillPack, and so many more. David and I talk about how they spot exceptional founders, what he thinks makes a good investor and board member, and how to build a prepared mind as you look to spot trends for the future. Prior to Box Group, David co-founded Techstars New York, so shout out to Brad Feld, who we've had on the show in the past as well. I hope you enjoy. This is The Road Untraveled. David, how you doing?
Hey, Brian, how are you? Thanks so much for having me on today.
Absolutely. Let's dive right in. If I look at the portfolio, it's generalist and fantastic. It's all things. It's Flatiron, it's Glossier, it's Harry's, it's Superhuman. Talk a little bit about what Box Group does that's differentiated and how you guys have set up such a phenomenal portfolio over the last 11 years.
Well, thanks. That's a nice intro to open up to. I think, first off, differentiating in venture is a hard word. I think we are at Box Group focused on finding people at the earliest stage who have a dream to go build something. And we feel incredibly fortunate to partner with some of those people and be a small and early part of their journey. And I think that that's the mentality that we approach our work with, is how do we meet people who want to go build something, really interesting and ambitious and exciting, and convince them that we are worthy of investing in their company. And so we're willing to do that in any space, because it's a people-focused lens that we approach this with. And so whether it's a company like Plaid or Airtable or Harry's or Glossier or Superhuman or Memphis Meats or Zipline or Row, These are people. Behind each one of these names is a group of people. Sometimes it's one founder. Sometimes it's three founders. Sometimes when you're meeting them, they don't have a name yet, or they're thinking through a handful of ideas. And sometimes when you're meeting them, they're on a mission to go build something very specific. And our job at Box Group is to meet those people and move quickly and confidently enough to make a great decision to invest in them, and then convince them that we're worthy of working with.
Yeah. If I went to some of those founders and fantastic teams that you just mentioned and did a little bit of surveying, why do you think they would say they chose Box Group?
Because we're funny and we make good jokes. Look, it's a services business. We don't have a product. We are on the other side of this, people. And we're people that you hopefully choose to work with. As an entrepreneur, you're joining something, hopefully a journey for 10 years, 15 years, sometimes shorter for bad reasons and sometimes shorter for great reasons, right? If you get an outcome 5 years in, it was an amazing 5 years. But I think what you have to focus on is people that you want to be in touch with and in essence supported by for that long period of time. And I think one of the things we do at Box Group is take an incredibly long-term point of view on the world. We've never sold a stock early. So we've never traded a single time on the secondary market to get out of a startup that we've worked with. We're in it with you from day one until whenever you are realizing whatever opportunity you're realizing. And I think that along that ride is, an incredibly supportive full-time group of investors. There's six of us. We all do this. We wake up every day and do anything we're asked to do as best as we can. And hopefully we'll respond to your email or your text message quicker than everybody else and try a little bit harder. And I think that is, what service comes down to is responding to your customer.
Love that. I remember listening to your podcast on Invest Like the Best. You said, at Box Group, we're a friend in a room, not a parent. How do you sort of align yourself with founders? What are some of the things you guys think are important as a board member or a member of a cap table to do well?
You listen to them and give them advice about the thing that they want advice on in a perspective that is to their advantage. So you never, ever speak from a place of selfishness. Mm-hmm. Friends give advice. Parents sort of tell people what to do. We don't know what to do. but we will happily talk through something with you and give you advice in a position that is not prioritizing us, but prioritizing you. And I think the sort of easiest time to do that is actually at the end of a journey, when you are, you know, fortunate enough to have an exit opportunity and you're trying to figure out how to cut the pie, slice the pie. You know, that's a great time for everybody to grab at the pie. It's the one time. And so in those moments, we've seen a lot of that. Giving a founder advice as to how to optimize for themselves while balancing optimization for everything, everybody else, I think is a better position than saying, here are the, you know, core interests that I am going to fight for and defend that benefit me. And so I think when you think about friend versus parent, you know, A, you're not telling somebody what to do, and B, you're trying to help them be the best version of, you know, what they want to be, because you're their friend and not sort of their boss.
Yeah, that's great. Let's reverse a little bit to the sort of origin story of Box Group.
You know, I tried to buy box.net, but Aaron Levy beat me to it. Yeah. Box.com is too expensive for all of us.
You ran Cornell's Startup Studio. You ran Techstars New York. What made you start Box Group?
Box Group's a natural story. It started with a single investment in a company called Boxy. I named Box Group because it was investing in Boxy, and I thought it was the only investment it would ever make. I never sort of foresaw 12 years later this being my career. And it was originated to basically make early stage investments in interesting people. It was sort of natural. There was no vision. I think we are very much as a firm and as a group of people about solving, you know, our short-term vision and not sort of playing into this, you know, here's the expectations we have for us over the course of 20 years. I think we have a North Star, but I don't think it's tactical as to how we're going to get there. I think we have to be evolving in a natural way as a firm, and that's what we've done. So we started with, you know, writing 25, 50K checks and then 100K checks and then 250K checks. And now once in a while, we'll lead a deal with $1 million check, but we write typically collaborative supportive checks in, you know, 40 to 50 new seed stage investments every year. And that's been what we've been for a decade now. And so I think it started with exactly what we're doing today, which is finding interesting people and being fortunate enough to join their ride.
Yeah. 50 deals is a lot. Let's challenge that a little bit. Some would call that spray and pray. Walk us through a little bit of your mentality around being able to do that many deals in a year and how you can sort of sift through a portfolio and triage during a time like COVID where so many of them might be calling you asking for answers.
Nothing like labels. Yeah, look, it's a model. I think, you know, I hate focusing on our model versus what's important here is investing in great companies. And so that's sort of first and foremost, diving into like the inside baseball of our model. You know, we believe that you're going to, as an investor, have a equal fail rate. So as a entrepreneur, you have an N of one. If you fail, it is a life devastating moment. You've really impacted your life, potentially your finances, your mental health. It's a devastating thing. So in no way would I minimize, you know, that happening. That said, you can't change the fact that that is inevitable in this business at a relatively high frequency. That's the nature of entrepreneurship, of startups, of early stage. And so in our view, if we can be fortunate enough to find as many great companies as we can that look and feel and could be great companies at the seed stage, we should invest in them. And so it's not about hitting a specific number. It's about finding people that we can close our eyes and sort of dream that they could build something amazing one day. And every investment that we make, we have that shared dream. They believe that they can go build something amazing, as do we. And if on an annual basis, that number is 30, then we're going to invest in 30 companies. Mm-hmm. But if on an annual basis, that number is 50, we're going to invest in 50 companies. And I think that is, you know, how we approach it. I think the balance is that we then need to go and help each one of these companies as best as we can to the point where they are feeling like we are worthy of being investors in their company, and that they will tell their friends and their family and their employees who leave to start a company that we are great investors. And so I think when we think about our model, it's find great people and do what we can to help them sort of fulfill their dream.
Yeah. Let's talk about the sort of modes of building top of funnel. I mean, I'd imagine from your time at Techstars, you certainly know how to sort of generate volume. I'd also imagine your founders sort of going out and vouching for you guys will bring in deals, but how do you sort of constantly find new rocks to flip over, new areas to look in, new ecosystems to be a part of? What are sort of some of the generalist strategies that you take to sourcing?
You wake up in a sheer panic every day. You need to go find great companies. And that if you don't, somebody else is. And what is that great company? And where is it? And how do you find it? And that's the truth of it, right? Like, that is my FOMO, right? It's like my deep anxiety every day is like, how do we find great companies? And our team is totally oriented around that. And so we all are looking for great companies. So I think first off, like, you have to commit to that focus. How do you do it? You know, you have to build these concentric networks, and that means sort of looking under rocks that you know you should look under, and then figuring out where are the other places nearby that are also worth pushing into. And that means, you know, if you work somewhere and you have a bunch of colleagues that are really smart, or you went to school somewhere and you have a bunch of, you know, friends that are really smart, or you have a portfolio filled with founders and companies that are really smart that people are going to leave and start, like, you have to be looking for deals. And I think that one is just the orientation of we need to find great deals is step one. And then figuring out where to do that. There are very few places that will guarantee you, hey, if you look here, you're going to find a great deal. Right? Those are Y Combinator. You went to Harvard Business School. There's good companies, great companies that come out of HBS every year. There are great companies that come out of Harvard undergrad every year, maybe MIT, Stanford. You know, Penn has a history at this point of producing great companies almost on an annual basis. You know, there are a handful of these named places, but everybody knows about those places. So if you're going to hunt there, you better have an advantage or figure out how to do it better than everybody else. And if you're not, find your community, right? Like, you know, there's a group of founders right now that are starting something that both me and you want to know about, and we have no idea where they are. Mm-hmm. And so if you wake up tomorrow, panic to go find them, maybe you will.
Is that FOMO worth it? Is the 11 years of waking up in that panic, have you found that fulfilling?
Yeah, because when you find it, it's really cool. You're like, oh my God, I've been waiting for you. And they don't know that, right? So you have to be like a little like less creepy than that, but it's true. But like, I mean, the amount of times I've just looked at a friend and I'm like, I've been thinking about you for so long. And it's not them. It's like the package. It's them, what they're working on, how they're thinking about it, their obsession about a space. And you're like, oh my God, my mind was prepared for you. Now, on the flip side, sometimes you meet somebody, you're like, I've never thought about that idea, but holy shit, you just woke me up to something. And here can you please take my money? And I think that that's the mentality that I wake up in every day. And that's how you can be successful at this job, is living in that mental space and not sort of finding yourself complacent with, you know, going where you went to yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some of those, if you were to sort of put your crystal ball hat on, some of the non-traditional venture hubs that you get excited about, where are some of the new places that you think over the next 3 to 5 years will start to generate more founders than they did in the past five?
Well, I think you've seen as technology shifted from a vertical to a horizontal, and as software has eaten the world, you've seen entrepreneurship come from so many different places because technology is touching so many different industries. And if you're working in, you know, a SaaS business or a dev tool business, there's probably more of a predictable style of, you know, starting origin. But if you're going to go build something in an industry, if you're going to go build something in oil or in commodities or in fashion or in retail or in, you know, a consumer product that is a tech distribution, you know, that founder can come from anywhere. And so I think predictable is hard. Are there, you know, where post-COVID is geography to me as interesting as it was pre-COVID? No, but geography was becoming less and less interesting. You're seeing great companies get built in small or unknown startup hubs. You know, Shopify building in Ottawa, Canada, it didn't hold them back. If anything, it probably helped them from building a $130 billion company. You know, you see Utah, you see Texas, you see Atlanta, you see, you know, they're interesting start. Chewy came out of Florida and not like the heart of Miami, Florida. And I think you can find that there is entrepreneurial activity in so many different geographies that it's not really about, you know, let's be only focus on, you know, our backyard, New York, or, you know, the hub or the Mecca, San Francisco in the Bay Area. It really is about finding those great, talented people with a dream and, you know, meeting them where they are.
Yeah. Let's talk about sort of identifying talent in sort of a reactive versus proactive way. How much of what you're doing is sort of thesis building and going out and looking for something versus reacting and seeing things and then sort of assessing it from there?
We're a generalist fund, so we don't invest in theses. That said, we try to walk into days and weeks and years with a prepared mind. So there are things that we've thought about. There are spaces that are intellectually interesting, or, you know, ideas that we are curious about, or sort of holes in the world that we would love to try to help fill. And so the magic is when you meet a founder who is thinking about one of those things. Do we go out and search for that person? Typically not, because as the seed stage, there's not really something to search for. If the idea exists, if there's progress, if there's traction, especially in this market, it's probably been funded and we're probably too late. So I think it's hard to be proactive around ideas or spaces unless you're sort of putting signs on the door and saying, hey, we're looking for this idea, please come visit. It's hard to attract people with sort of your idea expectation. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, you know, if you don't have a prepared mind and somebody shows up and starts talking about, you know, a broker-led logistics business to help the trucking industry, you're not going to be prepared to understand why it's interesting. And at the same time, if you're not aware of, you know, how remote work is, you know, creating new opportunities in HR, or why, you know, employees are feeling trapped with their equity options, you're not going to be prepared for the founder that walks in trying to solve a problem that those things have unlocked. And at the same time, you know, in the consumer world, if you're not in touch with basically the, you know, I'm old now, so a demographic that's a lot younger than I am, and what they're interested in, how they behave, and where their consumerism sort of lives, I'm not going to be able to fund the next great consumer idea. And so it really is about being prepared ahead of a founder explaining what they're doing, to the point where you're able to dive in and sort of meet them again where they are on their idea and ask, you know, the right questions to see if the way that they're thinking about it and the ambition that they have and the drive that they have is aligned with, you know, what you think is interesting. We have a phrase at Box Group that we say, we don't ever want to short the future. And so if there's an idea and we're like, okay, that might be relevant today. I see it, right? A marketplace today for like masks. Like I get why masks are popular today, obviously. And I think masks might be here for a while, but is that in essence, like an interesting venture-backed business? No, mm-hmm. In no way. And so mm-hmm. I think you have to bet on things that will grow over time in opportunity and not shrink.
Yeah, that's interesting. I want to run a personal thesis by you and let you destroy it. But I think especially for a generalist fund that builds a ton of volume like you guys, I'd imagine at a certain point, you could actually just look internally to your own portfolio to get a pretty good understanding of kind of where technology is headed and sort of how to get ahead of it. Do you feel like you use your portfolio to sort of thesis build and start to understand where to look?
It's a good question, so I'm not going to attack it. I would say it's an area that we need to get better and better and better at, because you're probably right. I think one of the best sort of things you can do is talk to a company at different stages and see what their operational pain points are. And you can learn a lot. I think that plays deeply into SaaS. I think in healthcare, you can talk to companies that are in market and observing, you know, problems. And so, you know, talking to Roman and the founders there, you know, they expressed that medical licensing was a, you know, big challenge in telemedicine, and it opened our eyes to an opportunity to make an investment in that space. And so I think the more time you spend with founders that are in market, you do get sort of their experiences that they're able to communicate that open up your mind as an early stage investor to, you know, holes that need to get filled by startups. Now, a lot of the time, like, they're not the only person that identified that. And a lot of the time there are companies trying to do that. And so therefore it's not like a sort of be all end all observation. You have to then go and figure out, like, you know, is this market already saturated? Is there somebody already winning and sort of on the verge of doing this that is, you know, impressive enough, or is this a hole that we need to go do?
Yeah. Let's stick on this idea of sort of benchmarking and utilizing the portfolio for a second. If you had to identify, you know, a few characteristics of just tier one high quality founders, what are some of the things that you've identified in your portfolio that you think makes them win, and sort of the things that you think you'll start to look for more frequently than you may have in the early days?
I think that the most important things in a founder that you can draw total horizontal sort of conclusions about are ambition, drive, and determination. So, like, how big are you thinking? How hard are you going to work for this? And, you know, how much do you want it? I think those are the things that, you know, it's a tough path normally. It typically doesn't just start and work. You're going to go up and down, and the downs are brutal. And so as you're going down, can you fight your way back up? Can you claw back up? And I think that is the most important common trait across a portfolio of successful people, is that ambition, drive, and determination. And then it comes down to what you're working on. Is there expertise that is required? And if there is your expertise aligned, or is your outsider perspective actually the more interesting one to bet on? Is, you know, we love to think of sort of, you know, a strategic thinker as the style of founder we get excited about backing. That strategic thinker needs to be married with, you know, a operational executor who is, you know, uniquely talented at that. And that might be one person. That might be a team of three people. The one thing that I think we've sort of figured out over the years, and we think is important, is when you take a step back from hearing an idea and you say, okay, what's the core risk? Is a core risk tech? Is a core risk product? Is it marketing? Is it, you know, a more operational logistics end of it? And you determine what that one main core risk is, that person should be in the room. So if you're going to try to solve something technical, and you have no technical people in the room, we're out. Mm-hmm. If you're going to try to solve something that requires, like, amazing consumer marketing, consumer DNA, we're out if you don't have that person in the room. And so I think that's the idea that I think we've leaned into heavily, is, you know, one of the lenses that we look at teams for. You need to have the most important thing that you need to do in the room with you.
Yeah, that's great. What are some of the things you think founders do wrong in the early days of their business that sort of put them on the wrong path and maybe a little more correctable if they took advice?
I think it comes down to every company, right? You have the product, you have to get the product right, and then you have to go to market, and you have to go to market right, and then you have team and culture, and those are sort of the three prongs. I might have forgot an important one, but go to market encompasses marketing and a bunch of other things. But, you know, those are the three things to me. And if you don't have the right team, nothing's going to work. Mm-hmm. If you don't build the right product, but you have an amazing team, it's not going to work. And if you build a great team and a great product, but you can't figure out how to sort of communicate it, sell it, distribute it, it's not going to work. And so it is this balance, right? Like there are very few companies that can ignore any of those three things. Sometimes the go-to-market is so easy because the market loves your product and pulls it with you, but that's not a great bet. It's not an easy bet to make that you can do that. And so I look at those three buckets as the buckets that, you know, founders need to balance and sort of have a plan for all three.
Yeah. I'm going to ask a little bit of sort of A, B questions to get your take on having to choose one or the other. There's no C here.
What about D, all the above?
There's no all the above either.
All right.
But would you rather have an incredible market and a decent founder, or an incredible founder in a decent market?
It's probably either or. So C, you've seen examples of great things happening in both of those scenarios. Oh, what I prefer, probably the great team in a not as great market, but market really pulls you forward sometimes.
Yep. Next one for sort of founder specific, one of the most technical founders or one of the best product visionaries?
Probably product visionaries. I think product visionaries, when right, can attract a unique group of people around them to help them build that. And I think, you know, a lot of the times the technical solutions required are people you can recruit, but the vision for where what you need to go build is harder to sort of outsource or recruit for.
Mm-hmm. One of the most introverted founders or one of the most extroverted founders?
I mean, it matters for what. If you're going to build a company that's a consumer-facing extroverted company.
There's no C, David.
The introverts are weird. It comes down to product founder fit, right? Why is this team the best team to go build this product right now? Sometimes it takes an introvert and sometimes it takes an extrovert. My assumption is the extroverted CEO is better positioned to build a motivated team around them than the introverted one who probably needs to surround themselves with some extroverts to help that team and culture build.
Yeah, that's great. I want to switch a little bit to just your personal DNA. You know, what do you think makes you who you are today? How does David the founder, David the investor, David the visionary, what are some of the things that you sort of think make you tick?
This is natural. This is where I want to wake up every day. And I think that in life, when you feel comfortable and you feel like you're doing what feels good to you, you're going to be better at it than when you don't. I think what I like to, when I was teaching, I gave students career advice of like, double down on your strengths. Don't try to fill your weaknesses. I think a lot of time in life, people tell people like, oh, this is one of your areas of weakness that you need to improve. And it's not that you need to like ignore it, but like, I would just figure out what you're really good at and lean into that. And so I feel very much like this is the opportunity that I get excited about waking up to do every day. And therefore I can try to be as good as I can at it. I think when it's forced, it's much harder to do that. And so I think that's one. You know, what else makes me tick? I'm obsessed with the internet. I grew up obsessed with the internet. Like when I'm bored, I go on the internet and like look at things and do things and try new products and like click on new random corners of the internet to explore. So I think this is again, back to like this natural fit. Like this is what I want to do when I'm bored, when I'm not bored. So yeah, those are the things that probably make me tick. I don't know if I answered your question.
Right. No, you did. Follow up similar, but just, you know, give a quality or some characteristic of yourself that you think just gives you your competitive edge. What's sort of the part of your background or experience that you couldn't live without?
I'm highly communicative and responsive. Mm-hmm. I think I have the quickest reply rate of anybody I know to any communication. It makes me get in trouble with my wife sometimes, but I get that screen time every week and it's like, your screen time's up 20% and I don't care. I'm good. Like I'm obsessively responsive in communication. And I think, again, back to like portfolio, that's how you juggle a lot of relationships. You have to be able to sort of treat everybody as though they're important and do that authentically. And the only way to do that is to be a hyper communicator.
Yeah, that's great. We'll get a decent number of young professionals and sort of up and coming folks on listening to the show. Just give a little bit of advice for college students on an area that you'd study right now. If you were going back and got to choose your major again to sort of set you up for success, what's an area that you think you'd be going into right now?
So I think if you're chasing a trend or something that's identified already, you're too late to it. I went to law school that was not the best for the use of what I wanted to learn for my future. But I do think that building a foundational set of frameworks, of skills, of knowledge can allow you to do anything. I sort of restated, do what you're good at. And so if what you're good at is, you know, being technical, lean into that. If you're good at product, lean into that. If you're good at, you know, business or marketing, lean into that. And then within those areas, find the areas that are passionate, that feel natural to you. I think there's a subset of entrepreneurs that are able to sort of get presented with a problem that they don't care about or love or feel passionate about and do something great in it. But that is a smaller subset than the people who, when they find the thing that they wake up and obsess over, they're going to be the best at doing that. Those are the founders that I think are more prevalent in success than the ones who are sort of missionaries.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's move up the curve a little bit to the kind of 2 to 5 year graduate that's dying to get into venture. I'm sure you get a decent number of resumes on your desk these days. What do you think is the key to getting into venture? What's the thing that sets someone in the resume pile to the left as opposed to the one that gets thrown away?
So we're swiping now. Yeah, the first thing is to understand that venture is a meaningless word. So Series B venture investing, Series A venture investing, and seed investing are different jobs. So what I do as a seed investor and what a Series B investor does is nothing to do with each other. What a growth stage venture investor does is nothing to do with sort of Series A investing. And so I think the first mistake people sometimes make is they just want to be a VC. I would narrow it down to stage, because I think within stage, there's a job. Within seed stage, it's about finding interesting entrepreneurs. Within Series B, it's about understanding and diligencing companies and performance. And at the end of each of these entry-level jobs in venture is the job that means you have to sort of sell and win deals. And so you need to map out your core sort of strengths to say, in that stage, in this area, do I have eventually the ability to win deals, to convince entrepreneurs that they should work with me over other people? And how do you sort of think about that as a, you know, 2-5 years coming out of school? Something like, you know, one is the people that you work with and learning from the people around you and sort of getting exposure and experience through that. And then two is you have to, again, be natural. I think you can develop more authenticity over time, but that the original fit needs to be there. So, you know, in seed stage, it's about intellectual curiosity. Are you able to dream? Are you able to close your eyes and see something that isn't there today and fill in the holes and say, I see how it's going to start here, but get there. At Series B, there's a, in C and D, there's a lot of sort of, you know, diligence-oriented discipline that goes into being a great investor and sort of knowing where to look. And then at the end of the day, like making the deal and getting the deal done. Those are different jobs. And so I think you need to first decide which job you want, early stage or sort of not early stage. And then, you know, stand out. So, you know, it's not about being able to find deals when you're not an investor. I think that's this exercise that's a bit weird to me. It's like the expectation that you come in and you like hand someone an investment. But I do think, you know, you can do exercises to show, you know, your knowledge, your width. Like, you know, one of the questions we ask on our survey when we hire is like, what's the most interesting site on the internet that we've never heard of or app? So that's not asking about an investment. We just want to see who you are and, you know, what brands do you love? And if your brands that you love are like Nike and Apple and, you know, Warby Parker, like you're going right down the fairway. You're showing me nothing. But I think that you have to be authentic, because in this moment, and hopefully for a long time in the future, that's what entrepreneurs look for, is somebody authentic that they click with, that they sort of want to talk to. And sort of the polished approach and sort of, you know, cookie cutter, generic, whatever it is, just I don't think wins this week.
Yeah. Move a little bit further up for the last one. What's your advice to emerging managers? Anyone kind of going out to raise a first time fund?
I have no idea.
You're not emerging anymore.
I sure am. I'm going to emerge until I retire. That's the hope.
Well, your advice to people that are going to have trouble fundraising. How about that?
We've only raised one fund and I don't know. I think for, you know, ventures about finding people that believe in you and what you're doing at your business. And so, you know, what I thought was most important was presenting an authentic view of who we are, the three partners at our firm, Nimi and Adam and I, and how we work and how we think about deals and how we think about building our business. And what we never wanted to do was have to try to be something that we're not. And if what we're selling isn't what somebody's buying, then we need to find somebody who wants to buy it. And that's not easy, right? And it doesn't solve the question that you just asked, but I do believe that, you know, just like a founder who gets a bunch of no's or gets ghosted a bunch, it happens on the other side too. And what you need to do is focus on the yeses. So I don't try to change people's minds. I think people can think of me, of us, of you, of anybody, whatever they want. And I don't think it's my job to change someone's mind. It's my job to present who we are and give somebody enough surface area to like or not like it. And there are exceptions, right? We talked to one of our LPs on the phone and she didn't like me. And luckily one of our other LPs who had introduced me said, like, she didn't like you. And I'm like, what do you mean? I thought that call went great. And we decided, me and the LP, that the best move was to beg her to let me come visit her and meet her in person. And I did. And I went down there, and 3 hours into the meeting, she looks and she goes, okay, I was wrong. And I'm like, really? Good. Because I didn't understand why you didn't like me, because I liked you. And she luckily decided to commit to our fund, and we have an amazing relationship. But so it wasn't that I like needed to change her mind. I didn't give her the right version of us. And I think talking to someone on the phone sucks. You don't get enough surface area. And so I think, you know, it's about being authentic to who you are. And there's a lot of people that are very interested in early stage and generally in venture right now. And getting in front of them and being yourself is probably the best way to get a good group around you to support you.
Yeah. Last one for you, man. This has been super fun. I really appreciate you
being
here.
Thanks for having me. Awesome.
Let's talk a little bit about either a newsletter or podcast that when a new one comes out, you can't wait to get to it. Something for people to go chase.
Television, man. I turn on CBS and NBC and Fox and ABC and I open TikTok. My head wants to understand mass consumers, and I want to know what like 80 million people are doing, or, you know, TV doesn't have that many anymore, but like, what are 30 million people watching? Yeah. So it's cool to be like the friend that points out the zeitgeist thing, but like, I want to know what everybody's doing.
Yeah.
So I don't like, do I learn a lot from like niche and zeitgeisty things? Sure. And that's part of like my daily content consumption. But at the end of the day, like, I'm much, much more interested to know what everybody's interested in than like what a small subset of people are like obsessed with. So I try to lean into that part of the world big time.
I love it. David Tisch, founder of Box Group. Thanks so much for being here, man. It's a ton of fun.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it. Great,
absolutely.
Great chat.
Take care.